Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me for the second half of today's show is Raj Singh, a tech innovator visiting Kansas City from Silicon Valley for the Mobile Midwest Conference. Good morning, Raj. Hi, Raj. Good morning. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem.
So your claim to fame is Tempo AI. Can you explain what that is? I know that entrepreneurs excel in the art of the elevator pitch, the two-minute encapsulation of an idea or invention intended to sell the idea in the time you might spend sharing an elevator ride with a potential investor. So Raj Singh,
that's right.
Let's hear the elevator speech for Tempo AI.
Yeah, I think the elevator pitch is usually 10 seconds.
10 seconds. Okay. You can have a couple of minutes.
Tempo AI is a smart calendar for your iPhone. And what we've done is we try to make you better prepared for your meetings. We do that by pulling together information from a range of places and augmenting your calendar with that data. So, for example, you can see information about the destination that you're traveling to, the drive time, information about the people, maybe emails or documents that might be relevant to the meeting, maybe Foursquare or Yelp or weather or whatever other sorts of information that we can find and display it alongside your calendar. In addition to that, we try to simplify your life. Being a business professional or a meeting-heavy kind of person, you may often find that you're running from place to place. We like to think of time as sort of the most critical thing. And so what we've done within the calendar is we have provided quick actions to do things more quickly. So, for example, maybe you want to navigate somewhere, so you can just tap navigate. Or maybe you have an upcoming flight, you can just tap view the flight status. Or maybe a conference call and you want to automate your way in. Whatever it might be, we sort of pull together the information that you need and then provide quick actions to help accomplish those tasks quickly for the business professional.
One of the things I noticed that I thought was kind of a useful feature was that you can warn someone that you're running late very easily.
Yes, yeah. So actually some of the inspiration behind Tempo came from that use case itself, chronically having always been running late. And then when you couple that with the fact that you're in the car and you're driving and you don't really want to be texting while you're driving, is there a more simple way I can do this? And so started with a really simple concept of just is a quick way of just sort of two taps, three taps, and boom, I can let somebody know I'm 5 minutes behind or 10 minutes behind. And I think that feature is used quite a bit, but personally it's been pretty awesome because I use it all the time.
So Tempo AI has the phrase AI, artificial intelligence, built right into it. What is the definition of artificial intelligence that you're working with when you imagine a calendar application that uses artificial intelligence?
Sure, yeah. So AI has many definitions, which span from sort of the computer science definition. If you go to the Wikipedia and you search for artificial intelligence, they'll talk about machines, to sort of the Hollywood definition, where I kind of litmus test it with my nephew, and he says, isn't it robots? So there's sort of both ends of the spectrum. We've adopted so we were incubated at SRI, which is Stanford Research Institute. If you're not familiar, they used to be part of Stanford University, and they've invented a number of things like the mouse and radar and GPS, et cetera. We've sort of adopted their definition of assistant, which is something that learns and something that completes tasks for you. And so when you think about the modern world admin or assistant, you know, they may help you to complete tasks. That's sort of the objective, but they may make mistakes early on. But over time, they're learning and they understand your interests, your likes, your dislikes, how do you handle particular workflows, and then they become sort of the perfect assistant. Really, you're taking that sort of human model and now translating it to a machine model. Can we get to that sort of point in software? In the case of a calendar, one of the things that we thought a lot about before starting Tempo AI was we saw the world of Siri, which a lot of people think of as the first generation assistant. So Siri, if you haven't played with on iPhone, being the product that Apple calls where you can ask questions and it responds. The sort of second generation Google Now, which I'm sure some people probably have played with, which is available on Android, which tries to predict or anticipate things you might need. So you pull down Google Now and it will tell you what the weather is upcoming or to tell you your drive time to work or It'll tell you how they, you know, the Oakland A's or whatever performed today because you searched for them earlier in the day and it knew you were into that sport team. But these are sort of two incarnations of the assistant. We really started at it with a different angle. We said, what would be the best business assistant? Just thinking about business and critical workflow. And we realized that the calendar was a great metaphor or channel for that because the calendar is effectively a representation of time. And when you think about business, it's all about time. And you know, it's all about meetings and you're flowing through meetings. And so we felt it would be great to put assistant inside the calendar. And so what we did was, as I mentioned earlier, we pulled together data using a variety of AI kind of technologies like semantic analysis and natural language and display that within your calendar. But then in addition to that, we provide a lot of simple actions to help automate common workflows, whether it's running late viewing a background around somebody or whatever it might be, just like an assistant to help sort of automate those tasks. So that's how we think about AI within the calendar.
So semantic analysis, would that be like if I have been emailing with someone and we've discussed the details of a meeting and what we're going to do there, and then that information is actually understood by the program?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so semantic analysis has a range of a lot of these definitions are overloaded because they're used in different ways and different contexts. But generally, it's a machine being able to, or software being able to parse and understand text. And as simple as that may sound, it's an incredibly hard problem for software to do, to read an arbitrary sentence and understand the nuances between the use of his and her or whatever it might be. To then what we like to say determine intent, and intent being ultimately what does the user want. So if their intention is to buy something now, then it's a good time to push them a coupon, for example. Or if their intention is to go watch TV, then it's a good time to push them show recommendations. So understanding intent is ultimately the end goal here.
That's kind of an interesting thing because one of the things I was thinking when you were talking about trying to replicate the role on some level of a personal assistant, a human being who might serve that function. One nice thing about that arrangement is that the person requiring an assistant, in theory, trains the assistant, and that assistant can become really knowledgeable and really capable in anticipating what this specific person is going to do, not what a theoretical person is going to do. And I guess I wonder, you know, one of the things that can be sort of aggravating about technology trying to anticipate what you're going to do is when the technology gets that wrong, the spell checking things, when the technology thinks it knows what I'm trying to say and it absolutely doesn't. It has no idea what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely.
Is there a way that the specific user can train this technologically based assistant?
Yeah, so I think there's really two questions there. One, absolutely. When software or even people get it wrong, people get frustrated, and especially if it gets it wrong over and over again. And it's a very, very hard kind of problem for software. And there's a number of different techniques that they've implemented that I'll talk about here in a second to try to mitigate that. But you are correct in pointing out that one of the really interesting phenomenons that has happened here is we are building personal models for each user. So historically, if you think like Web 1.0, they had a general website, and everybody would come to this website, and it looked the same for everybody. And then in Web 2.0, if you think things like Netflix and Pandora and some of these services that some of your listeners might have used, they have recommendation engines. And these recommendation engines, where they suggest other content that you might like, are built on clusters. And so what they do is they effectively group a subset of people together, saying these people appear to be similar because of their viewing habits, and these people appear to be similar because of their viewing habits, and they may have 50, 100, 200, 500, who knows how many clusters, and that's where these suggestions come from. What's happening now is we sort of have enough cloud and computational power that we can actually take this to the next level and say, hey, can we just personalize it to the end user directly? And so the suggestions are tailored to just you. And this is kind of a novel concept, and especially important when you're thinking about assistance. Regarding how do you sort of train the system? There's, in the AI community, there's sort of two ways you train a system. So there's what they call implicit learning, and there's explicit learning. Implicit learning is sort of defined as the as sort of latently monitoring the activities that you do to try to determine likes and dislikes. So a good example of that is if you click a video on Netflix and you watch 5 minutes of the video, does that imply that you liked the movie or didn't like the movie? If you just looked at the preview and then went back but didn't actually consume the video, what does that mean? If you watched the whole video, what does that mean? So tracking your sort of general use behavior to try to use that information to create a better understanding of you. And ultimately, an understanding of you is very, very sort of important, because as you think of next-generation software becoming increasingly anticipatory and more assistant-like, you want it to have a better understanding of who you are, so it pushes relevant things to you. The other form of learning is explicit learning, and a good example of that is something like Pandora, where you can simply put thumbs up or thumbs down. And so by doing so, you are actually training the system that this is stuff I like and this is stuff I don't like. But it on its own can be a challenge as well, because some users are very active about it, but many times you're just sort of listening and not really bothering to teach the system. So ultimately, what a lot of these services do is it's sort of a mix of everything. It's a mix of looking at usage patterns of other groups and clustering you together into a persona type. It's implicit learning, just sort of looking at your activity, and it's explicit learning from you grading or scoring the system. And then the combination of that is how it tries to develop its best understanding of you to deliver the best sort of assistant experience. But even with that, it may still get things wrong.
Well, Raj Singh of Tempo AI, I want to switch gears here and talk exactly about getting a better understanding of you. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a mobile entrepreneur?
Sure. So mobile was a little bit by accident. I have a typical sort of entrepreneur story. I think, like most others, I was doing my master's in college in 2000 in computer science, saw some high school friends who started a company who were successful with that, and I'm like, you know what, I can do this myself, and so I can do this too. And so I actually had gathered four or five of the smartest kids from the computer science department at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo in California, and we would meet on a sort of weekly basis and just brainstorm ideas, and we had a range of different ideas. Decided to pursue one of them. And at the time, it was a meta file sharing network. So it was a tool so you could search Napster, Nutella, Scour, all of these applications at the same time. One of the big differences between today and 2000 is a lot of the content and tools and resources for entrepreneurs and mentors were not available back then. It was kind of a new thing. There was sort of a club that you needed to be within. And so it was really, really difficult being 21 years old and not really understanding what a business plan was and not really understanding how you raise money or how do you go to market or what is the definition of success and team dynamics. And, you know, prior to that, all of my experience is really just sort of summer internships. It's just a snapshot of what the real world is like. And so one of the things that we were fortunate was we were able to parlay through a professor some local mentors, and realized that a great channel for us was to apply to the business plan competition at the college. And so we bought a book.
And what college was that?
Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo in California. And so then we bought a book, How to Write a Business Plan. We wrote a business plan. It looks nothing like what I would do today and how the world has evolved. But we actually wrote one, and it probably is pretty garbage. I haven't gone back and tried to read it. We presented it at the business plan competition, and we won, and that's how we got our initial money. And then through that, we were able to attract some more mentors and raise a little bit more money, and that's sort of how it got started. And then after that, series of ups and downs and trying different things. And one of the things that's really interesting, it wasn't really until 2005, that I said, hey, maybe I should stay in mobile. It was sort of accidental up until then, and obviously today, everything is mobile, everything is digital. That's where it sort of started. And then since then, once you get the itch, one of the nice things with these things is failure teaches you a lot, success teaches you a lot. So you keep learning and you keep iterating and you learn new things because the market evolves and things change and how what it takes to be successful changes as well.
Hey, Raj.
That's
something that I've been really intrigued by as I've been sort of reading about your background a little bit is that there's this constant reference to your being sort of an early innovator in the space. And for those of us who aren't techies, that the space seemed just sort of jumped out at me. And I kept noticing more and more of this very sort of specific kind of language. And I wonder if there in Silicon Valley, if do you feel that you all are speaking in some ways your own language?
Yes, definitely. So we call that our own sort of bubble, the Silicon Valley bubble. Mark Cuban sometimes refers to this, even off Shark Tank. He talks about the people in the valley and their way of doing things and inflated valuations and how they think about things. The space in this context is really the industry, so it being mobile. But definitely we tend to believe in our own hype cycles, believe in our own hype curves. And Silicon Valley is its own unique thing, just sort of the combination of universities, location, weather, and capital that's available.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because there are some people in Kansas City who really have very high aspirations to make Kansas City, if not the next Silicon Valley, at least a next sort of tech innovator, a place where a lot of innovation comes from. So what makes Silicon Valley in your estimation? Is that something that can be transplanted just anywhere?
I think, there's an interesting piece of research I saw from, I think it was Samsung in Korea, that was doing an analysis to try to understand what it would take to build Silicon Valley anywhere in the world. So let's ignore Kansas for a second, but anywhere. And they had identified three things, and then I would add a fourth thing that, I don't know if you know Vivek Wadhwa or Dr. Vivek Wadhwa from Singularity University.
I do not.
He's kind of infamous on sort of, he had the debate with Peter Thiel over TechCrunch for a while about whether you should drop out of high school to start a company. Peter Thiel's funding companies to do that, or funding students to do that. But in any case, he had another sort of item that I would add to this list of three regarding what it would take to start a Silicon Valley. So the three sort of things that this Korean company had, or Korean government had sort of identified was one was location. People want to live and work somewhere where it's nice, whether it's weather or space or urban or whatever it might be. So that's sort of the least out of your sort of control. The second thing was good universities. And so, when you think about New York, which has a pretty good tech community, they've got Columbia and NYU, Boston, which historically has been a good tech community. They've got, obviously, MIT and Harvard. And, you think about Seattle with the U of W, University of Washington graduates. In Silicon Valley, we have Stanford and Berkeley nearby, as well as San Jose State. So sort of good universities and that they're...
And good universities with good reputations.
Sure. Maybe not. Yeah, but, just creating the talent pool of computer science and engineering graduates to help feed the startup community. So you need students, otherwise it's sort of difficult. So location, universities, and then the third thing they'd identified was access to capital. So basically a community with money that's willing to invest. And so when you think about a lot of these urban centers like New York and San Francisco, there's one of the nice things is there's capital from the technology community, and then they're reinvesting into the community. And that's a beautiful sort of thing because I have seen within other parts of the regions one of the challenges being that a lot of times the folks at the capital don't come from technology and so they don't understand technology, or the technologists themselves ultimately make money and then disappear and don't reinvest back in the community. And so access to sort of capital. The fourth thing I would add, which Vivek Wadhwa had brought up, was access to mentors. And this is an interesting thing because he brought this up in the context of why India hasn't been able to create a Silicon Valley. And one of the things that he had identified was successful entrepreneurs in India will often then become unavailable or inaccessible and sort of disappear. And so there wasn't a community that would pay it forward and sort of mentor the next group of people. And without the lack of mentors, and I know what that feels like, having gone through trying to do startups in 2000 and 2003, prior to the world today where there's so much more accelerators and incubators and so many more tools and resources like AngelList, et cetera, to provide you access to these mentors and resources. It's super difficult because you don't get that sort of professional feedback, and you end up spending 2 months to try to understand and learn and realize you did something wrong when you can learn that in 30 minutes. And so those are sort of the four things that I think are necessary to create a Silicon Valley. And I think Silicon Valley is really unique because it is a very much pay it forward kind of mentality.
Yeah.
In that you can ask anybody for 30 minutes of their time, and it's unlikely they're going to say no.
Okay, I'm going to jump in real quick. I want to get back to some of the things you just said, but I do need to tell our listeners that you are listening to KCUR 89.3 FM streaming live at kcur.org. The show that you are listening to is Central Standard, and we have just a few more minutes, but we'd love to get you in on this conversation. Call quick and tell us, what do you think Kansas City would need to do to be a contender? Do we stand a chance, or is this absence of a coast or mountains or other such natural splendors maybe a deal breaker for us? What about our investors? Are they risk averse, or could we create with the investors here a true culture of innovation? Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We will do our very best to get you in. And Raj Singh, one of the things you were talking about was investment. It seems like part of the process you were describing was things failing, things succeeding, and like a comfort level with that process. Does that also translate to the kind of investors who are well suited to invest in innovation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Silicon Valley and technology has a very different kind of investment cycle and approach. Traditionally, when you think about a business, and this, again, might be me just speaking Silicon Valley speak, but typically, you do X and you make revenue, and then you grow and you get acquired for some multiple of that revenue, or you grow to that business ultimately to a point where you start, you know, becoming the business that people want to sell to. Silicon Valley, oftentimes, given the nature of software, and this is changing because software has become cheaper and easier to write, and there's a number of tools to help accelerate things. But often there can be a longer lead time before you start making revenue. Maybe it's not day one, but it's 6 months or 1 year or whatever it might be. And so the metrics of success to get to that point are different. It might not be revenue, but it might be users or engagement, engagement meaning how much you're using the service or traction, whatever it might be. And this kind of model is different to a lot of other kinds of businesses. And so, you know, I had some friends, I remember in Houston, who were telling me, you know, they're meeting a lot of wealthy oil businessmen who want to invest in technology, but then don't understand the technology model, how it's capitalized, meaning how much investment it takes to get to a certain point, and what the ownership and dilution looks like over time. And so, it is kind of its own unique thing, which does help or benefit those that have worked in the technology space. I mean, it's sort of taking the Warren Buffett rule: don't invest in spaces you don't understand. But I do think it's improving, and I think that's mostly happening because technology is disrupting all sorts of businesses.
And the mentorship piece, I would imagine that in an industry that's changing so fast, that it would be hard to find people who could have really long-term, enduring experience that's still relevant to you today as you're anticipating the future. How do you even have mentorship in something that by definition is changing yesterday?
Yes, so absolutely. A great example of that is some people would come to me and ask me, hey, what's the funding climate like for raising venture capital in Silicon Valley? What's the process like? And I'll usually immediately respond, I can give you some feedback, but what I did 18 months ago is not what's working today because it changes every 6 months. The highest value person would be somebody who just went through that process. I think the key here is not just there's obviously some common themes in terms of the lessons learned over time in being a mentor and providing that access, but the other thing is networks. So mentors may usually often are people within technology because tech sort of folks are always curious about the next technology sort of thing or breakthrough, and so they do keep loosely abreast of the whole category, and so they may have networked into other people who maybe more up to speed or who more recently went through a similar pain. And there's a lot of that sort of introductions between friends, to the next degree, to the next graph, and serendipity in that process, which ultimately may help you get to an aha moment more quickly, or realize something that you're doing wrong, or get access to an opportunity that you didn't even think about.
If you were just in a very quick way to tell, if you were a mentor to someone, what would be your piece of advice? Think Mrs. Robinson in plastics.
The one thing that has really changed in software today has been, it's very hard to predict success. So you may think that this is perfect and you're going to put it out there and it's going to be amazing. And then you realize the market reacts or behaves very, very different to what you had anticipated. My sort of recommendation is build immediately and get it out there as quickly as you can.
All right. Speaking of getting out as quickly as you can, which I know is not what he meant, our time is up for today, but I'd like to extend a huge thanks to Raj Singh, the innovator behind Tempo AI. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
To listen back to today's show, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. And join us again tomorrow to hear from a professor who teaches a course on the psychology of hate. What is hate and how do we recognize it as distinct from other distressing emotional states? Plus, how to distinguish between a hate crime and an act of terrorism. That's tomorrow on Central Standard. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Christy Garten and intern Kate Baxendale. Today's announcer is Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.